So, hi everyone, and welcome to this week Quantum Gravity Seminar. This week we have Shaikh Jabari, who is from IPM, the Institute for Research in Fundamental Science in Tehran, and he will speak about null surface thermodynamics. Shane is also fine with questions during the talk, so you can ask anytime by raising your hand on Zoom, or you can also ask anonymous questions via the Google form in the chat. And with this, Shane, you can start whenever you want.
Okay. So thank you for your kind invitation. As announced, I'm going to tell you about null surface thermodynamics. This is the title of one of my recent papers. This is actually, this seminar and the work that we have done is based on several papers that we have written with this group. And in particular, you should know Celine Zwickel, our collaborator, who is now a postdoc at PI. Okay, so let me start with a brief introduction about gravity and thermodynamics. As you know, a very distinctive feature of gravity is its universality, in the sense that every matter, by just its mere existence, gravitates. And similarly, thermodynamics is very universal, irrespective of the details of the system that we consider, we see thermodynamic behavior. And of course, these two universal theories are deeply interconnected and related. For example, the relation between these have been explored since early 1970s, the last 50 years or so. It started by within black holes, where the seminal work of Carter, Barden, and Hawking, and then followed by works of Bekenstein and Hawking in early 1970s, and then formally put on a much firmer ground by Robert Wald in early 1990s. So you all know about this black hole thermodynamics. Then Bill Arnrough, shortly after, gave this basically put this in a different view perspective, and he showed that any accelerated observer would see a thermal bath. And a milestone was basically taken by Ted Jacobson, who showed that Einstein equations actually follow from thermodynamics. And basically reversing the discussion that was earlier brought up by Hawking and Bekenstein and collaborators. And then maybe another different perspective was given by Erich Verlinde, who basically argued that gravity is an entropic force. And then there are various different discussions and results on based on the AdS-CFT and holographic principle, which basically explores different relations between gravity and thermodynamics. Now, from looking from a different angle, let's suppose that we have space-time, which has a boundary. This boundary could be a physical object or some hypothetical hypersurface, co-dimension one hypersurface. And this is exactly the problem that I'll be interested in. When we have boundaries in the space-time, we need to introduce boundary degrees of freedom. And these are basically the degrees of freedom which are only residing at the boundary, but they could be interacting with the degrees of freedom that we have in the ball. And in my talk, I'll be focusing on the case where the boundary is some region within the space-time, and it's not as usually considered in the asymptotic region, but most of what I'm going to tell you at technical level extends also to asymptotic boundaries. In particular, for theories which have gauge symmetry, for example, gravity, This boundary degrees of freedom could be labeled by surface charges associated with the non-trivial gauge or diffeomorphisms. I'll try to spell out what I mean by non-trivial diffeomorphisms. And here I'll basically try to take the viewpoint that instead of the bulk, I want to focus on the boundary and try to formulate the boundary degrees of freedom, the boundary theory, and as much as I can, I only want to focus on the boundary and treat the bulk modes as things which are affecting the boundary dynamics. So this is the viewpoint that I'm going to take. Which is sort of orthogonal to the usual viewpoint that the bulk modes are given some more importance. Okay, and within this setup, I'll basically try to show and argue that the boundary degrees of freedom for gravity theories naturally follow a thermodynamic description, regardless of the details of the boundary dynamics, the gravity theory, and it just follows from the diffeomorphism invariance of the theory. So this is basically the general setup and the outline of my talk. I'll review very briefly Einstein GR equivalence principle and presence of boundary degrees of freedom. In particular, I'll take the boundary to be a null surface. This is motivated by black holes and where the horizon could be viewed as a boundary. And I'll try to explore the boundary symmetries and the charges associated with them in a generically dimensional example. And from this analysis, we'll see that the certain null, what I'm calling null surface thermodynamics is appearing naturally. And I'll end, of course, with some outlook and summary of the results. Okay. Let's suppose that we have a generic gauge theory described by this action and a Lagrangian over a manifold M. And let's suppose that we have a gauge symmetry which acts on this field in this usual way, or alpha is a representation of the gauge algebra. And by invariance, I mean the two transformed actions and the action over the transformed field and the original field, initial field are the same. As you know, in gauge theories, the physical observables are gauge invariant quantities and fields are or observables are defined up to gauge equivalent classes. Usually gauge symmetries are viewed as redundancies of the description and we try to remove them by the usual gauge fixing procedure. But in presence of boundaries, we need to sort of revisit this standard gauge fixing procedure and take special care as we'll discuss. In particular, let's suppose that we have a boundary around M and the value of the fields phi alpha at the boundary are denoted by this var phi alpha and their variation by the same notation. Basically, now one can ask whether the, after gauge fixing, there are some residual gauge transformations and one can ask how they act on these var phis. And as we'll see, there is a certain measure zero subset of gauge transformations which act non-trivial at the boundary and the boundary value of the fields. And if one can associate surface charges, well-defined surface charges to these gauge transformations, the boundary gauge transformations, they are actually physical and non-trivial because they could be used to label the boundary degrees of freedom, as I'll describe in more detail. Okay, So this is actually a handy way to identify and label boundary degrees of freedom. Just to basically give you a more intuitive picture, I'm not talking about something very abstract, just this is basically a familiar problem in within, for example, Maxwell theory. Let's suppose that you want to formulate Maxwell theory in a given box. This box could be, for example, a perfectly conducting surface or anything else as you wish. So we have photons which are basically propagating in the ball, within the box. And then we have boundary degrees of freedom, which are basically their role is to ensure that we have a certain boundary conditions for the Maxwell field at the boundary. So basically, these boundary degrees of freedom adjust themselves to ensure certain boundary conditions, which are basically defining what the boundary is. So in other words, basically through the analysis of this non-trivial gauge transformations, we are able to give a macroscopic, if you wish, a formulation for the boundary degrees of freedom without basically knowing anything about the details of what the physical boundary, for example, the perfectly conducting metal is. So this is a sort of the kind of formulation that will be very useful in studying, for example, black holes, and when we have the horizon of a black hole as a putative boundary. So that's please.
Yes. Do you also add boundary terms to the action or Hamiltonian?
Okay. This is a very good question. I'll come to
it. Okay. Okay.
So let's get to the question that we are interested in. We want to study gravity described by Einstein GR, and its very distinctive feature is that it's a generally covariant or diffeomorphism invariant theory, and the physical observables are, of course, local diffeomorphism invariant quantities. And diffeomorphisms, general coordinate transformations, act on our dynamical field, which is metric in the usual way. We partially fix these diffeomorphisms when we choose our observers. And within Einstein GR, I'm going to consider pure gravity in this talk, but all what I'm saying naturally and easily extends to when we have an arbitrary matter as well. So the Einstein equations of motion, are basically governing the degrees of freedom, the metric that we have. In a d-dimensional spacetime, we have this much number of metric components, which decompose into d times d minus 3 over 2 propagating gravitons and d diffeomorphisms. And we have, of course, the same number of equations, Einstein equations, out of which this d times d minus 3 over 2 are second order differential equations, and then we have the constraints, the Bianchi identity. These are first order equations for metric components. And one can fully specify the solutions by the boundary or initial data. So, for example, in an asymptotic fact spacetime, we know that pure gravity, pure Einstein gravity, is a well-defined Cauchy problem, and specifying the Cauchy data, we know the metric at all times everywhere. And so if my boundary is space-like, it could be treated as a Cauchy surface, but the boundary could also be null or time-like, and these are actually the cases that I'm interested in. In general, for this problem, I need to specify 2D functions over co-dimension one boundary, for example, the Cauchy data, that space-like surface. So this is the kind of problem that we have in mind. And as I said, I'm interested in the null boundary because it's modeling horizons of black holes that I'm interested in studying their properties. So for example, consider a usual Schwarzschild black hole. We have the horizon, this H plus and minus, this 45 degree lines. And let's suppose that we are an observer sitting in this region one, who has access to, limited by the sky plus and sky minus and the horizons. So if I want to formulate physics only from the viewpoint of this observer, this observer would see the horizon as its boundary. So this is the sort of setup. More generally, actually, I can basically forget about the black hole horizon and consider a generic null surface, the sigma 45 degree line. It could be a horizon of a black hole or it could be an arbitrary null surface. And I parameterize this null surface such that it resides at r equal to zero. And the, I'll be sitting at r bigger than zero part. And I'm going to excise the r less than zero from the spacetime. So I'm interested in formulating physics only in one side, you may call it outside region of this null surface. And this null surface itself is parameterized by V. You may view it as a null time direction. We could have null infalling null rays, but there's nothing which can come out of this. Any future-oriented causal curve would be basically moving only from R bigger than zero to R less than zero region. And so I want to only focus onto observers who are sitting at r bigger or equal to zero in this region. And I'm asking what kind of degrees of freedom I need to add to the boundary residing on sigma such that they can compensate for the part of the spacetime that I have cut out. So this is the kind of question I'm going to formulate. Okay. In this case, the boundary is not a physical object, it's just a putative null surface. So, and the question is how to label these boundary degrees of freedom, how to identify them, and how they should interact with the stuff that I have in the box in this region to account for the part of the spacetime that I'm choosing not to look into. Okay. So, let's start. Let's start with the metric, which has this property that r equal to zero is a null surface. I've adopted this coordinate v, r, and xi, standing for the transverse space. I and j run from 1 to d minus 2. Here in the metric, I have f, eta, hij, and gi. And I'll be using this convention that I'm calling GI as vector in this co-dimension two surface. HIJ is the tensor, eta and F are scalars. And to start with these functions, F, H, and G are functions of all coordinates, R, V, and XI. And eta is only a function of V and XI. So this is the most general form of the metric that I can write and with this adapted coordinates. And the feature that r equal to zero is a null surface is leading to this relation among these coefficients of the metric. Okay. So in this ansatz, metric ansatz, I have decompose metric components in this way. And hence I have three scalars, one vector and one symmetric traceless tensor. I have taken the determinant of H out and put it among the scalars. And these functions are subject to Einstein field equations. And what I'm going to do is to impose Einstein equations perturbatively around r equal to zero. just looking into the details of the Einstein equations, I don't present the details of the equations, but this is the outcome. This Hij, the part that the determinant is set to one, actually the follows the second order differential equation in R and is hence fully specified by two functions h0 and h prime 0 of v and x prime. The vector mode gi is fully specified by its value at r equal to 0 because it follows the first order differential equation. The three scalars are governed by the Rache-Hilbert equation and the condition that sigma is a null surface. And this allows for solving F in terms of the two other scalars and GI. So all in all, after imposing Einstein equations perturbatively around R equal to zero, I remain with two scalars, eta and omega, which is basically the square root of the determinant of metric in the transverse part, one vector, and two tensors. So this is the counting. Again, I emphasize that in this analysis, I only assume the smoothness of metric around R equal to zero, and I did not impose any other condition. Of course, R equal to zero is taken to be a null surface as well. Okay. And R equal to zero is, while a null surface, has no other special feature. It could be any null surface anywhere in the space-time. It would be handy to use a different parametrization for the functions in the metric, as I've written here. I've introduced gamma instead of F, and I've introduced this G, and J is the first order term in R, and Hij is denoted by omega to zero order in R, and then the rest. So this is an expansion around R equal to zero. Just some conventions. I take omega ij and I basically take out its determinant and put the determinant free part as gamma ij. And I introduce this covariant derivative along this sigma null surface, which is basically denoted this way. This is the lead derivative along the vector gi. Then in this null surface, I have an expansion as we usually do, for example, study these expansions. And it's of course related to this, the time derivative of this omega, the square root of the determinant metric. And then we have the news vector tensor, which is basically the time derivative of this tensor mode, the Nij. So this Nij is actually formulating or parameterizing gravitons which are passing through the surface. After this, I remain with Einstein field equations at R equal to zero. So I am imposing the Einstein equations perturbatively in R, and these are what I remain with. These are equations at R equal to zero. This is basically the definition. This is the standard Rache-Hilbert equation written in this parametrization, where P is defined as log of eta over expansion squared. And this is the Damour equation. So these are all very familiar stuff written in some appropriate parametrization.
So is there some meaning to the color code here you're using?
Yes, actually, the color code is denoting the charges. So as we'll see, these are omega, P, and J are the surface charges. And then the other stuff are appearing as so-called chemical potentials, if you wish, in the charge analysis.
Remind me, so omega is the scale factor, but gamma, what's the...
This gamma?
It's like the mass at infinity, and here it's...
This gamma is more like surface gravity at the null surface.
Right, okay, so that's the surface gravity.
Yes. And
can you fix it, or it's a, so no, there's no dynamical equations for that, so you can
no it's a free parameter exactly.
It's
a free parameter.
It's a background, right? It's a definition of your null surface.
You can view it that way. That's true. So it's not fixed by the dynamics. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it's your choice whether you want to parameterize your initial data or the data at the boundary in terms of the charges or those so-called chemical potentials. It's your choice.
And then you're saying, so gamma is a chemical potential and theta then is also a chemical potential.
Yes. Theta is not a chemical.
Okay, it's also
we'll come to this. So if so, we'll come to this and we'll see this very explicitly. So I choose to parameterize my solution space in this way by these parameters: omega p j and n I j. These are and then the h prime. So this is fully parameterizing my solution space, and then the rest of them, I would like to view this equation as an equation for gamma, since it was discussed. And then this equation as an equation for theta. But this is my choice, okay? And the reason why I've chosen this will be clear in a moment. So as I've written, these are Einstein equations projected at r equal to zero, and this gamma and gi could be solved in terms of this other color stuff. Okay, so I've constructed the most general solution space or set of metrics which satisfy Einstein equations perturbatively around r equal to zero. And if I consider higher order expansions in R, I need not specify or give you any further information. The solution would be fully specified through these functions. So this is a full construction of the solution. It's fully specified through these functions. Okay. Now let's explore the residual diffeomorphisms. I can ask what are the set of diffeomorphisms which keep this metric as it is or rotate me within the solution space that I have just constructed. Namely, I'm asking which diffeomorphisms are keeping R equal to zero as a null surface. And one can easily check that these are basically the diffeomorphisms which does the job. So if you shift V by only a function of V and X without R dependence, obviously this is not going to change R equal to zero. If you scale R in an arbitrary way that I'm parametrizing by W, again, you're keeping R equal to zero as it is, or you could rotate XI with the function of V and X, YI. And these transformations obviously keep R equal to zero as it is, and rotate me within this set of metrics that I have. These residual diffeomorphisms are parameterized completely by a function, scalar function T, time translation, you may call it, scaling in R, W, and a diffeomorphism on this codimension two surface. So, these are basically the set of symmetries and two scalars and a vector. So that's how to remember them. And of course, since these are rotating me within the set of metrics that I have, this means that these are basically, for example, acting on eta and taking it to eta plus delta eta and the rest, similarly with the rest of the functions that I have in the metric, but basically keep me within the same set of solutions. And going back to the parameters that I had in my solution space, I had two scalars, one vector and one tensor, and then two tensors, basically Nij and H prime. Here, the residual diffeomorphisms are two scalars, T and W, and a vector. So they exactly match this part of the solution space by count. Okay. And since I have the full solution space, I have transformations which rotate me within the solution space. These are basically generator of symmetries, as we have learned in undergraduate, in basically all the Noether. So this is basically the standard Noether symmetry procedure. We can use Noether charges to associate charges with these transformations, or something which is a bit more covariant, and I'll come to this. So before going on, just to summarize, we have d times d minus 3 propagating gravitons. Half of them are in Nij and the other are in H prime. We have d scalars and vectors, two scalars and one vector as the boundary. Okay. So just moving on with the, I want to basically, it's some generalized Noether procedure, the so-called covariant phase space formalism, which basically associate gives me a way to associate charges to these symmetries that I just showed. And these charges are given by surface integrals, integrals over four-dimensional two surfaces. In my case, these are constant V slices on the sigma. Okay. I'm happy to discuss the details of this if there are any questions after the seminar. But going through the standard, but maybe a bit lengthy computation of these charges, this is what I end up with. So I was asked about the boundary term in the Lagrangian, whether it affects this or not, and I'll comment on those. So this is the expression for the charge variation. I've denoted by delta slash, and this slash is used because it's not complete variation over the solution space that I have, because the coefficients of these variations, as you can see here, do depend on the functions, gamma and g and theta and so on. So this expression is clearly not integrable on the solution space, okay? So this is why I use slash. This is given by a co-dimension two integral on nv, the constant v surfaces on sigma. And then this is a linear combination of my symmetry generators w and t and yi, and the variations of the fields which are parametrizing my solution space. So this is a generic structure of this sort of results for this concept, or for the charges that I have when I use covariant phase space formats. Okay, so this is of a general form as I've written. And as you can see, the parameters that I have color coded, this was the reason I used this color coding, are appearing as the charges. Okay, so since I am dealing with some charges which are not integrable, the usual way to deal with these things is to separate these charges into an integrable part, which is the total variation over some function in the phase space, and the so-called flux part. This is basically a method developed by Glenn Barnish and Cedric Rosar in maybe 11, 12 years ago. I won't go into the details of this because it's not so important for the sake of this discussion that we are having here. But this is a very technical remark, and I know that there are many experts in the audience, so this is a comment for those people, that one can always choose the freedom or ambiguities in this covariant phase space formalism such that the integrable part of the Barnish-Trossard charge is identified with the Noether charge, the charge that I obtained using the standard Noether theorem. It is always possible to do so. And among you may see recent papers by Friedel and Robert Lee for a discussion on this. And I'd be happy to discuss this if there are any further questions. But for this discussion, it is enough to note that one can always do the same. Identify the Barnes Trossard integrable part with the node surcharge upon the choice of W freedom or ambiguity. I prefer to use freedom rather than the more common word ambiguity, because it's just a sort of freedom that we have in the definition of the charges. Since Lismon asked, actually this W freedom is ultimately related to the fact that one can define Lagrangians up to total derivative terms. And those total derivative terms, the boundary terms, do not enter into this covariant phase of space formalism for the computation of charges. However, when I do the separation of the charge variation into an integrable and the flux part, that freedom or ambiguity resurfaces. We have the same freedom or ambiguity when we are computing node surcharges. We need to specify the boundary terms in the Lagrangian because they affect the node surcharge. And these two actually could be sort of fixed together such that we get this equation that I've written. So this is based on very technical remarks. So I just didn't give you the details, but this is the take-home message, this equation. The node surcharge, actually, if I just use the standard.
Hi, can Sammy. I ask you a question? I mean, do you have an idea which boundary term you should add to reproduce exactly that node surcharge?
Yes. So it is a covariant boundary term, but if you ask about the details of its form, I don't recall it, but we have it in our paper. So. I mean, in our paper together. So, but the important point is that there always exists such a boundary term, a W term, which equates.
The ambiguity, I agree. But at the level of the Lagrangian, can you write some term at the level of the Lagrangian?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And this is, I believe, what Laurent Freidel has in the papers. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can discuss this after the seminar.
Yes,
but,
yes.
But this is, okay. So the node surcharge is given in terms of, by this surface integral, as I've written here. Omega is the charge associated with the scaling of the R direction, the W. J is associated with the diffeomorphisms on this co-dimension two surface. And the time translation, the charge associated with time translation is this combination. Okay. And the flux has this form. You may note that the flux, this P and N ij, appear only in the flux and not in the node surcharge. And omega and jr are appearing in node surcharge, and the charge associated with T has this form. So these are the things to remember.
Okay. So just a question about,
Please.
Just a question about your energy. Because I thought that in Einstein Hilbert, the energy term is the expansion. But here you have this gamma omega. So can you comment on how you...
The
term proportional to T there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. So let me first remind you that this T is translation the null time direction, the V. Okay. It's different than, for example, the usual time if you have a causal, a time-like observer. And this is comment one. The comment two is that this, as I mentioned, this gamma or minus gamma is actually related to the surface gravity at the null surface. And this you may view it as... temperature times entropy. This is basically what I'm coming to. This is exactly that I'm coming to. And this is the work done by the angular momentum. This is basically the angular velocity, if you wish.
Okay.
Okay. So the answer to your question is exactly what I'm coming to. This is the rest of the seminar.
Okay.
But the notor charges associated with the so-called zero modes, when I take, for example, T equal to one, I have this, which you may call it energy or the null energy, if you wish. This is the angular momentum associated with this partial I, and the scaling RdR is basically its charge is omega. You may note that this is basically like the.
Can I ask another question? At this stage, anything you're doing doesn't depend whether the surface is at finite or infinite, does it? Could you take simply the limit, or there's divergence hidden if you take the limit? Okay. Or it's just a naive question at this stage?
No. This is a very good question. Actually, there is a technical part that I need to deal with if I want to take this null surface to go to infinity. And the reason is some of the expressions that I may have may explode as I take R to infinity. So as long as R is for any finite number, all these equations are fine. But in particular, if I want to take it to infinity, I need to take care whether all these expressions remain finite. And actually, we have checked this in our papers and in some other examples. For example, Celine and collaborators and some others have studied this, Glenn Barnish and others, that the part which explodes could be actually always, in the examples that have been studied, reabsorbed into a Y freedom, Y ambiguity that I didn't talk about here. So one can always regulate, if you wish, the cases where we deal with asymptotic boundaries, if we consider the other freedom that we have in the definition of the charge. So that's the, and again, once we did so, we regained the same expressions. This is, I don't have a better understanding, but that's what the result of the analysis the math is telling us. And the charge variation associated with dV is this expression. As you see, this is not integral. Okay. Then one can actually check explicitly that all the charges and the flux satisfy this equation, that the time derivative of the notor charge on shell is equal to the flux. This expression, which is in the usual context, is called balance equation or the bond in use equation or different, this is different names. And this is a manifestation of Einstein equations projected at the boundary, the Ray Schroeder and the Moore equations. And you may view this either that way or as a generalized charge conservation, that the variation of the charge is equal to the flux, and the flux is basically parametrizing how much of these charges are moving through the boundary. Okay. And, or you can view it differently, that this flux, which is basically parametrizing how, for example, gravitons are passing through the surface, is forcing these charges or the boundary degrees of freedom to readjust themselves. So this third viewpoint is particularly interesting because I'm going to, as I told you, I want to excise the space-time beyond this null surface sigma. And I just want to know how the boundary degrees of freedom should readjust themselves for when, for example, a graviton dissolves into this boundary, such that basically my physics does not need to consider the part which is behind this surface. So you can view this in many different ways, but maybe this last one is closer to the viewpoint that I am going to take. So, so far so good. I just took you through this charge analysis, at least gave the taste of it. Let me briefly remind you.
Sorry, Shane, I think there is a question by Lee.
Okay, please, Lee.
Yes, Is that basically the corner, the analysis of the dynamics of general relativity restricted to the corner? There's also something else that people call it, which I'm not remembering, but it's in the papers of the Marseille people.
Okay, so
let me ask it a different way. Which is your Boost Hamiltonian?
Okay, so the equation that I just showed is nothing but these equations written in term in disguise. So nothing else. So it's just written in a different parametrization, but its content is exactly these equations, nothing else.
Right. Is one of your equations the equation that the Boost Hamiltonian close to the horizon is proportional to the area?
That's not among this these equations, but actually I have those. So depending on what you call the Hamiltonian, if the Hamiltonian is the generator of translation in V, then actually we have something very similar to what you'd mentioned. I'll come to that. Actually, that's basically one of my thermodynamical equations. Exactly.
Yes. Yes.
So, just very briefly remind you of some basics of thermodynamics. As you know, in any thermodynamic system where we have n chemical potentials denoted by mu A, and a temperature, we have conjugate variables, which are the charges, QA, the entropy, and the energy. So there are n plus two charges and n plus one chemical potentials. I'm counting temperature as one of the chemical potentials. Then we have the first law, thermodynamics, which is basically telling me that this combination of the charges and chemical potentials, it is a complete closed one form over the phase space, thermodynamic phase space, which that one form is D of the energy. Okay, so that's how I read the first law of thermodynamics. Then we have the Gibbs-Stoem equation, which is basically relating, it's a one form equation over the thermodynamic phase space, which is relating the chemical potential, D of the chemical potentials and the charges in this way. And combined with the first law, you can basically read E as a function of the charges and the entropy and chemical potentials. So all in all, after Gibbs-Stoem equation is basically telling me that you can either parameterize the system with the chemical potentials and the temperature, or the charges, which are the entropy and QI. Okay.
May I just ask my question? So if the energy is the Boost Hamiltonian, you're right up next to your null surface when you're boosting. Then the entropy is the area. That's basically the common.
Yes,
and
exactly.
That's basically the content of the Einstein equation.
Yes. So I'll try to put this in sort of maybe more interesting packing, but that's exactly what I'm going to tell you.
Right.
Okay, so let me just try to repackage what I told you about the surface charges and the chemical potentials and so on in terms of this thermodynamical viewpoint. We have this D minus one dimensional thermodynamic sector, which is parameterized by the gamma surface gravity and the GI, you may call it angular velocity, and the conjugate charges omega and JI. Then we had this P, which is basically appearing in the flux, but not in the neutral charge. And then the bulk modes, which are parameterized by Nij. And this, the Nijs are conjugate to omega ij. So these are the transverse part of the metric. This Nij frame just parameterizing the flux through the flux of gravitons through this null surface. And hence, from the viewpoint of the boundary, actually the boundary system is out of equilibrium because there are stuff which are coming into this and dissolving onto the boundary. That's how I describe this, if I excise the space-time at the boundary. Similarly, P does not appear in the charge, But basically, it parametrizes alpha thermal equilibrium if I just view it from the boundary dynamics point of view. So this is basically my thermodynamic repackaging of what I just told you about the charges. So, and when the expansion is zero, as we physically expect, the system is entering into some thermal equilibrium, and we expect to have a normal closed thermal system. But in presence of the flux and when theta is not zero, we do not have a closed system, and we are out of thermal equilibrium. Okay, and as you have already anticipated, I just rewrite what I showed you in terms of thermodynamic quantities, or read it through thermodynamic interpretation. That's how I put it. So delta H, which was one of the charges, the charge associated with ron V, the derivative respect to V, could be rewritten in this way. So S is basically omega over 4G. T is, as I told you, is the surface gravity over 4 pi. Let me just remind you that this is the same equation that I have here, nothing else. I'm just rewriting it. Okay. I'm just rewriting this by giving some different names, more appropriate names. So this is my first law. Something to note is that these are all functions of V and XI. So these are local equations at the boundary, whereas the usual thermodynamic first law is basically something which does not typically depend on the spacetime. Okay, this is part one. Comment two is that unlike the first law for the closed systems, thermodynamic systems that I showed, here on the left-hand side, I do not have D of something. It's delta slash, which basically is a manifestation of that the fact that the system is an open thermodynamic system. And we have open thermodynamic system because of these two last steps. If it were not for these, if I have no expansion, which actually implies an ij equal to zero, I remain with the usual first law. Okay. Then the expressions for the Noether charges.
Just a question. Sorry, I'm just confused. I think I missed something. Like, what is the difference between H and P? Because I thought earlier you said that the energy is P. So H is what? Or maybe I'm confused. Sorry, here, like E.
H is the charge associated with the charge variation. One. Yeah.
Okay, wait, sorry, why you have some, sorry, my bad, okay. And this P is still ln the eta over theta squared.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
So,
can you say what you understood for the rest of us?
Let me comment on what you asked, Lee, earlier. This is what you would usually call a boost, the generator of RDR, and its charge is exactly the standard entropy area over with up to a factor of 4 pi, area over 4G. This is what you may call energy with respect to the null observer. This is the charge associated with d by dV, which has this expression. And this is, of course, what you one would usually call angular momentum. And for the usual cases, for example, when we have this ADM decomposition, which is a special case of what we are discussing, this reduces to the usual ADM angular momentum, and this reduces to the usual ADM mass.
Right.
And this is the boost generator, if you wish, because R is my null direction.
Right.
Okay. So for special cases, these do reproduce the usual results, the expected ones. This is actually the expression that I just showed, the generator for d by dv, the Noether chart is, sorry for shifting this up and down, but this is the same equation that I have here. This expression is my energy, but it could be written in a local way without the integral. This is this gamma over 4 pi, and this is the entropy, and this is the basically as the work associated with the rotation. And again, this is a Gibbs-Dolomb equation. For the special cases where my null surface is the horizon of a stationary black hole and so on, this reduces to the usual relations that we know among the charges of the black hole. Okay, so far so good. But again, let me emphasize that these are these two equations are local at the boundary. So you may ask about the zeroth law and the second law of thermodynamics. I'm just basically taking you through this zeroth law. Zeroth law is basically a description, a statement of thermal equilibrium. And as I just discussed, in general, my system is not out of, is not a closed system. It's out of equilibrium. But if I turn off intuitively, everybody would say that if you turn off the bulk flux through the boundary, you need, you should get something which is in thermal equilibrium. And I want to see how in my equations I can check this. So actually, the zeroth law tells me that there should exist some function g over the phase space, the solution space, which satisfies this. And this is exactly this right-hand side is nothing but the what I had as the flux. If the flux is a total variation, then I would expect that I am in thermal equilibrium. This means that the usual first law could be written in, instead of delta slash of h, could be written as delta of some h. So that's the statement that is written here. For those more experts of this topic, actually, this is the statement of the integrability of the charge on the solution space, and or at the same time, respecting, if I want to respect the variational principle. This is again going back to the question Lee asked earlier. About the boundary terms, I did not actually care whether I'm respecting variational principle or not. And the answer is, in fact, one can always respect variational principle upon addition of appropriate boundary terms and boundary equations of motion. So I did not fix that and I kept it open. But here I can choose this condition such that that variation principle is also respected. So, but then this is a non-trivial equation because the delta of the left-hand side is zero and hence the delta of the right-hand side should also be zero. So this is the integrability condition for this equation 13. And this integrability equation, one can try to solve it and first, this equation is satisfied, could, or this G can exist if Nij is zero. This is a necessary but not sufficient condition. And this, the rest of the equation, so this is basically matching with the usual intuition that the flux should be zero. And then basically the rest of the equations that comes out of this or the integrability condition takes this form. So these are basically the same equations written in terms of this sketch.
Beautiful.
Okay. But you can easily recognize these equations if you remember the Ray Chaudhuri and D'Amour equations. Okay. This is the Ray Chaudhuri equation. This is, remember, this is gamma as Laurent was asking earlier. This is the same equation in the absence of n. This is the Ray Chaudhuri equation. This is the D'Amour equation. And if you plug this back for T as dV of P, plug it back here, you see that dV of P is the variation of H with respect to S, and dV of S is variation of H with respect to P. So these are basically telling me that this H is a Hamiltonian over some phase space. And I have the usual Poisson bracket equations.
Beautiful.
Actually, the zeroth law do not specify H, but tells me that I need to have a well-defined Poisson structure over my solution space. Okay, so this is a very important message to remember, that the Hamiltonian is not specified through this. And this is again related to lead to your question, that I did not specify the boundary Hamiltonian, the boundary Lagrangian, and the Hamiltonian, which is playing the role of the energy, or the Hamiltonian for my boundary system, is not specified. So the only thing that I get as a zeroth law is the Poisson bracket structure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I guess I've run a bit of out of time. So let me just conclude. The first thing to remember is that in presence of boundaries, we need to include boundary degrees of freedom. Boundary degrees of freedom could be labeled and classified by surface charges, which are associated with non-trivial diffeomorphisms. There are many different formulations to construct the surface charges. I use covariant phase space formulation to basically construct the boundary phase space. And just going back to the construction that I gave you, my solution space had a boundary part, the two scalars and the vector, and the bulk modes. And actually, I needed both of them to fully specify my solutions. One can basically try to quantize this and view this instead of solution spaces or phase space, you can view it as a Hilbert space. So this is the next step that I just jumped. So the quantization procedure can go through because I have a well-defined Poisson structure over my phase space. Then in this viewpoint, actually the Einstein equations projected at the boundary, namely the Damore and Rache-Hilbert equations, or the balance equation, or the boundary Newes equation, these are all different names for the same thing, is telling me, after all, how the boundary degrees of freedom should readjust themselves when some flux from the bulk comes to the boundary. So these are basically, you can view them as some continuity equations from the boundary viewpoint. So this is the basically telling me how the boundary degrees of freedom react or interact with the bulk degrees of freedom. Okay, so these are how I read from the boundary viewpoint. The Rache-Hilbert equation is telling me the interaction or fixes the interactions of bulk and the boundary degrees. The interactions of the boundary modes remains unfixed and it's still open. Okay, and let me emphasize that all these, the Rache-Hilbert and Damore equation and the thermodynamic description that I just told you about is only a result of diffeomorphism invariance of the theory. I didn't use anything else. So these local laws of thermodynamics are basically appearing as a result of diffeomorphism invariance and is hence expected to be very generally true for any diffeomorphism invariant here. So I didn't discuss the second law of thermodynamics. This is yet a work in progress, but I can give you some hints how one should go about this. The starting point, as the usual in the usual black holes, is the focusing theorem. And one can establish that since I have a null surface and only flux can go through in one way, basically, I can expect that since the energy which is passing through the flux, through the boundary has a certain sign, the flux of the energy, I would expect that the same specific sign should be sort of somehow related to the change of the area, the temperature, the entropy. This is somehow how one can try to formulate the second law, but this is still a work in progress. And a different reading of the Arachidori and Damour equations is, which is very common these days, is the memory effect. So basically, this is a sort of effect that is sort of imprinted on the boundary degrees of freedom as we have fluxes passing through the boundary. So these are the imprints of the bulk modes as they pass through the boundary or dissolve into the boundary because we have excised the part of the spacetime behind the boundary. So I try to basically focus on the boundary and try to view things as a boundary observer would see. And I hope that this new viewpoint with the emphasis at the boundary could be helpful with the understanding of problems associated with black holes, in particular black hole microstates and the information puzzle. I'll stop here and take questions. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks, Shane, for the nice talk. Now there is time for questions. So just raise your hand or speak up.
Should I see the chat or?
Yeah, so I saw that there are indeed a couple of questions in the chat. I think the one the first one was by Nosratu, if he's still connected. Yes, I think so. Nosrat, you want to ask your question?
Hello, Shine.
Hello.
Thank you for a nice talk. I wrote it. It is a long question. And do you hear me?
Yes, yes, please.
I have a conceptual problem with general relativity on very small scales. I mean large B, large dimension. If you have large dimensions, it means to me that you have small scales. If you accept ball reciprocity, then for large x coordinates and small p, p means momentum. We expect general relativity. On the other hand, for large momentum but small x, we should have another equation going to the space. In summary, for large scales, we expect a curvature in spacetime, and for large momentum, we expect curvature for momentum space. Then, if this reciprocity is true, is valid, what do you think about general relativity in dimensions more than four? I expect something like general relativity in momentum space for small scales, for a high energy region and small scales, small spatial dimensions.
Well, I'm not sure if this question concerns my analysis here.
You have the general relativity in more dimensions,
yeah? No, no. My theory or analysis was generically true for any dimension.
Yeah, yeah. If you go to dimension more than four, yes, then this reasoning is correct.
No, but I don't see where in my analysis anything can go wrong in any dimension other than four.
You don't have any dimension more than four?
No, no. There, four dimensions is nothing special in my analysis. I don't see how anything can go wrong if I am working in dimensions other than four.
I think that for dimensions more than four, we should go to a small region.
Why?
Not very large scales.
And why?
In a small region, you have usually high energy and high momentum there. then in high energy near to Planck scales, you should have some curvature in the molten space.
No. Wait a second. There is nothing Planckian here. There is so in no large energy, nothing like that. So no small scale, no very large energy. Everything is just within the standard GR limit. So the typical energies, the typical distances. So I'm not sure if the question you're asking is concerning this setup that I just discussed and the analysis that I just made. You may have some point, if I have tried to quantize this, you may have wondered whether, for example, in that quantized version, I may face some problems. But remember, actually, I tried to establish that I'm dealing with a phase space. I dropped the space-time picture that I had, and basically I constructed this boundary phase space. And everything is now going on in my phase space. I don't give a space-time description. I have a well-defined Poisson structure. You can see explicitly the Poisson bracket structure that I have. In particular, for example, this S, you may think it as the entropy or the entropy density. And this P, which is basically one of the charges that I had, are conjugate, canonical conjugate of each other. And the H bar is 1 over 4G. Okay. So you may try to quantize this by replacing the Poisson bracket with the commutator and promoting these functions to operators on some phase space. But again, since I'm not giving a space-time picture for this, and everything is going on in some solution space, phase space, Hilbert space, that's fine. I don't face the problems that you're concerned with in this analysis.
Hey, maybe we can discuss this matter also through emails.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, so there are, I see two questions. So first, Laurent and then Lee.
Uh-huh.
Okay, it's me.
Sorry.
So my question, Shane, is like, can you comment on your picture of how you do with the radiation, like the subleading in the transverse metric? I mean, do you see them or not? Because I'm expecting that the equation function cannot determine them. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So this is a very good question. I had a short comment on this. So this is basically related to your question. The tensor modes were described by H0 and H prime, okay? And if you just go back through the equations, my Nij is
only the first derivative of
Yes. Okay. But you can view it as an independent function of x, v and x. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
the Nij is only constructed out of this H0. H prime is out of this game, so it does not appear in my thermodynamic description. And you can understand why. Just going back through this picture, actually. I told you that I have infalling rays, and these are parameterized by this Nij, but there could be gravitons which are just moving along this. Okay? Mm-hmm. And these are the H primes. They do not enter into my thermodynamic description. They are not fixed by any of these equations, and they are just there.
Sorry, but Shane, like the subleading in R.
Not really. So again, so let me try to give it differently. If we try to rewrite solutions, some wave solutions, we have sine, for example, sine kr and cosine kr. So these are the modes that different modes with k being the mode number. Okay. We have the waves which are like sine kr are vanishing at r equal to zero.
Mm-hmm.
But they are there, and they are parameterizing, if you want, a quarter of the graviton modes. So we can have infalling outgoing rays, and they can come with different polarization, right?
Sure, but
and H primes are those which are like sine kr.
Okay, but yeah, but even deeper in the bulk, you should have some modes that, I mean, you cannot reconstruct radiation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, but since I'm focusing at the boundary, they do not enter into my boundary equations.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. Thanks.
Lee?
Okay, yes. Thank you, by the way. It was a beautiful talk, and thanks for addressing my question. So let me give you a different circumstance, and it seems like their formalism will apply to it, but let me know if I'm right about that.
Oh, okay.
I want to consider I'm inside a space-time, a relativistic space-time, and I'm an event, and I want to be concerned with the backward light cone of that event. That's a null surface.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know if your analysis applies to degrees of freedom on that null surface in the backward light cone of some event, but not zero,
mm-hmm.
but a generic event.
Okay. So let me try to see if I got the question. So are you, for example, asking what happens if I had considered this H minus, or what happens in this intersection region, or is it the kind
no,
of...
Can I have the question? What Lee is asking is that suppose you have an event in space-time, and he tell me if I'm wrong, then you just look at the null surface, which is the backward light cone of that event.
Okay.
So null surface, it's not H plus or it's minus, it's just... Uh-huh. So he wants to know whether you can apply this... what you're talking about, that situation there.
Yes, yes. Okay, so...
Lee, am I representing correctly?
Yes, perfect.
Okay, thank
so
you.
He wants like a more kind of a quasi-local analysis, if you want.
Right.
Okay, good. So actually, on this V direction, I can move up and down. So I took this... V direction, the generators that I was calling the energy is taking me along this upward, mm-hmm. but I could have chosen them to be different. So if you wish, this T could have been chosen to be a negative number. So this T could be taken to be negative number, a constant mm-hmm. negative. Okay. So I can move both directions on V. If that's a part of the question that I was asking, right?
Right.
But this is my choice, as I understand, this is my choice to choose the sign of the energy, what I call the energy. But my energy, as it stands, is not bounded from below.
Right. But I want
that, positive or negative values.
Yes. I'll always take the... So this special point, which is the event, is in the future of the light cone.
Okay. So yes. So then, by taking that, I think I can guarantee that the energy is positive.
Right.
And but this is one choice for this time. It's not coming out of my analysis.
No. What I'm looking for is there degrees of freedom in the null surface, which mm-hmm. propagate parallel along the null surface to the point, and there are degrees of freedom that cross the null surface that are like your external radiation coming from above.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what I'm interested in is if your method can give me a beautiful analysis of how the different geometrical quantities in the region of this event vary as a function of the degrees of freedom which cross it,
mm-hmm.
which cross that null surface.
Yes, I think so. I think this, so let me, this is a sort of, if I understand it, is sort of like a setup that we have in memory effect settings.
I don't know that, but maybe.
Maybe
if I can, but I think, Shane, you're talking about the usual setting where, let's say, you're thinking of a long surface, which is you know, there, and you know, something that mimics a synthetic infinity. We talk about memory effect, but I think Lee, tell me if I'm correct.
No.
It's a more quasi-local analysis, maybe closer to Jacobson, where somehow you have an event and you look at the neighboring null surface around, and you try to understand, the deformation reaction to local change of geometry, so really quasi-local.
Is that yes?
And exactly. That's not the context in which you're doing what you're doing, but it seems to me that you see what I'm saying. You can extend the application of what you're doing to maybe refine Jacobson's perspective. I think that's the question of Lee.
Yes, of course.
Does that make sense?
Yes, of course. But let me emphasize: all the equations, the thermodynamic description that I gave, are local on the boundary.
Good. Okay?
So this I think it takes me one step further than Jacobson.
Yeah. So there may be a subtlety, which is if you have a local event, you're going to have acoustics. Right? So the theta at that event vanish, and that's going to affect your definition of P. So there may be some extra maybe gluing conditions. You know, like the notion of locality might be taking some kind of limits.
Yes. Okay. So this is a very good point.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes. So let me make some comments. First of all, I think Jacobson's description, while very nice and very intuitive, but it has one big shortage, that it doesn't tell me why I should get Einstein equations. Why not, for example, some other gravity theory? And this discussion actually improves on that issue in two different ways. First of all, it basically tells me that this thermodynamic description, which is a local description, it's much more than what we have in black holes or horizons of black holes. It basically tells me that this is only a result of diffeomorphism invariance of the theory. So but through these discussions, I cannot distinguish between Einstein gravity or any other F of R or any other diffeomorphism invariant theory, for example. The only thing which would change is the expressions that I have for the charges. Like, for example, instead of this omega, I'll have the Wald entropy charge. Okay, so this is all coming from the analysis that I just showed. So this is comment one. The comment two, which is related to what you were saying, is basically coming from this fact that all the equations that I showed are local on this sigma. Mm-hmm. This is a co-dimension one surface, and these are all local. So I can try to compare, for example, V and V plus dV region here.
Yes.
And this is what I meant by a memory effect. So what I was telling you is a field theory version of a memory effect. It's much wider and broader than what is usually called memory effect in the literature. So I'm just looking at this area element here. And basically, very locally, I am asking how basically this very local element sees the memory of what has passed through the boundary.
Yes, good.
So this is actually what probably Lee was asking for. And this is very much what you would call quasi-local.
Mm-hmm.
So again, my equations are local on this signal. So it contains all the information that you were asking.
Yeah. Very good.
Okay. And then there was another situation that Laurent was explaining, and this is very interesting. So let's suppose that, for example, this sigma is actually the horizon of a Schwarzschild black hole, and something falls into the hole, and it resettles onto some other stationary black hole, okay? The two endpoints are very naturally falling into the description that I was just describing, but the process itself does not, because the horizon does not remain the null surface through this process. whereas I am just considering my boundary to be always a null surface. Okay, so I need to describe the dynamics of this situation. That is very interesting indeed. I need to extend this analysis, which allows for this sigma to become also a causal, a time-like surface. Okay, so because in this situation that you just described, we start with the null surface, we end up with the null surface, but in between we are dealing with the time-like surface. So I need to extend this analysis to be able to describe the dynamics of the process. However, if you're only interested in the two endpoints, you do not ask for how this resettling into another stationary solution happens, I can just answer this question within the formalism that I just showed. Mm-hmm. So actually, we are working now on the extension that I just described to be able to basically take you through this process of that I just mentioned, things falling into the hole dynamically. Mm-hmm. So there are some small changes, but this thermodynamic description still remains there. So that's the punchline of that analysis.
Okay, so I don't see other questions, and anyhow, I think we ran out of time. So I would like everyone to thank again Shaheen for the nice talk and discussion.
And
see you all next week. Yes, Shaheen.
Sorry, let me ask one question to Laurent in particular. Are you happy with the description that I just gave here on this slide from your work?
No, I agree that the ambiguity is just completely controlled by the Lagrangian and the Noether charge. Yeah, that's the main point. There's no ambiguity in my view. Once you fix the Lagrangian, there should be no ambiguity.
And also it connects Barnes-Trossard to Noether, basically.
Yes. So there's a second version where if you extend the phase space, you can construct this Barnes-Trossard bracket as a canonical bracket.
Yes.
That's a more recent result. Yeah, which I like very much, because for me, for a long time, this Barnes-Trossard bracket was very ad hoc, right? It's not canonical. So I think now... it opens this possibility.
Yeah. And how do you like this freedom instead of ambiguity? Because ambiguity is have more negative tone in it.
I agree. Yeah. No. For me, yeah. Yeah. It's there's a choice of Lagrangian, which is a choice of quantization framework, but then there's no ambiguity. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's a freedom maybe in how you parameterize your phase space.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you all for having me here and for the fruitful discussion.
Thank you.
Thanks, Shaheen.
Thanks.
We managed to join. That's great.
Yeah. If you thank us, it's so late here. It's like 11 p.m. or something.
You're lucky that it's the Austrian time to eat, so we could escape.
Okay.
After the dessert, yeah. It was perfect.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the talk.
Very nice. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.